Let's turn back now to our continuing coverage of the Paris attacks and talk about the reactions both here and abroad. Just this afternoon, officials in Hanover, Germany, canceled a Germany-Netherlands-friendly soccer match after receiving, quote, concrete evidence that someone wanted to set off an explosive device in the stadium. That's according to the Hanover police chief, who spoke to German TV. And this morning, the European defense ministers unanimously voted to invoke an article of the Lisbon Treaty that provides, quote, aid and assistance to any EU member country in case of armed aggression. EU officials say the mutual defense article is being used for the first time, which means that all 27 other member nations of the European Union, must support France, even though exactly what that means is still unclear. Meanwhile, President François Hollande has continued putting pressure on the Islamic State, and today French warplanes destroyed an ISIS command center and training camp in Raqqa. So joining us now to discuss the international community's response is Farah Pandit. She was the first ever special representative to Muslim communities under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and she's an adjunct senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations. Farah Pandit, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us is Adil Najm. He's dean of the Frederick Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. Dean Najm, good to have you back.
Thank you.
So first of all, Farah Pandit, if I just may start with you, and I'll get both of your reactions to this. Tell us what you think about the European Union rallying in this way around France.
Well, I think it's a positive and important step. I really think we need to be thinking about this in terms of a rallying, to use your word, echo much more globally in the ideological space. You've heard a lot about how countries want to come together and fight ISIS in the military side of things, which is essential to break the momentum of ISIS. But I think what we ought to be thinking about now in the wake of this horrible tragedy on Friday is breaking the emotional and psychological momentum by reducing the number of recruits, and we can do that.
And Dean Najm, your response?
I think it is, Farah is exactly right. It is a rallying, but also, as you said, it's not clear what it means. So it's the right thing to do. It's the obvious thing to do. And I think that's the feeling of helplessness, which we as individuals feel, but countries are also feeling. We've kind of tried all these things. We keep going through a pattern after each one of these attacks, which is, you know, we'll go military, we'll stand in solidarity, we'll say we are with you, and but we don't know really what to do. And that's what makes individuals, as well as I think the international community, feel a bit helpless, unfortunately.
So this is quite a sobering observation you're making, because, I mean, it's been, 14 years now since 9/11, where we had, you know, a coalition, we had a rallying, we were trying to change hearts and minds. Do you really feel like that we're literally facing the same sets of challenges with very little difference?
Well, the difference every time is more people are dead. There's more fear. Hopefully we've learned something, but there is a certain pattern to it, right? You can go through world geography, New York, Madrid, London, Nairobi, Paris, Peshawar, Beirut. You can just go through this, and each time, it's not that our grief is not real. It's very, very real grief. You know, last night, we at Boston University at the Pardee School, the students and the faculty got together in a town hall. You could feel the grief, but you can also feel the mechanicalness of the pattern. I hope we learn each time and do something better, something more effective, something that actually works.
Okay, so Farah Pandit, President Obama, in fact, in a way, spoke exactly to this this palpable sense of frustration and grief on Monday when he was at the G20, because, you know, he talked about not believing that a solely military solution is what's going to break the back of groups like ISIS, that diplomacy and politics are also involved. But then he also spoke in quite a bit of detail about breaking the narrative that he says ISIS is constructing. How do we do that? How do we break this ISIS narrative?
So I would go back to what Dr. Najm was saying, and this is really important. There is frustration, and there is grief, and there's emotion, and there's passion from all sides to do something more. But we have to stop talking about it and do something about it. And what does that mean? government understands that the narratives of extremists, whether we're talking about ISIS, the Taliban, whether we're talking about Al-Qaeda or Al-Shabaab, are based upon a narrative of an us and a them, and that ideology is seeping into potential recruits around the world. So this is a global problem. The group that we're talking about right now, ISIS, is preying upon nearly a billion, with a B, young Muslims under the age of 30, mainly in the digital sphere. And we need to launch a proportional attack in the digital space that has not been mounted. Mm. And that kind of response cannot be, by the way, from government. Government is not credible in getting into fighting a one-on-one digital battle with those who are trying to recruit one-on-one. What we have to do is amplify credible voices at scale and in a proportional way using many platforms, and we have the capacity to do it. So when I think about the frustration and the hand-wringing about what are we going to do, the answers are clear. Meghna, you yourself have said after 14 years, we find ourselves in this place. Are you kidding me? We have so much more data now in 14 years after 9/11 about how young people get recruited, what's happening to the adolescent mind, how we can think about the identity crisis that's taking place. We haven't utilized it in the way that we can, and the reason why, frankly, is because there has not been money to give to the credible organizations and individuals at the grassroots to be able to scale up what it is that they know they can do.
Let me jump in here because there's so much in what you just said. I am curious about one thing, because you wrote about this in Bloomberg, I believe, that I'm reading your article. There has been much talk of the, quote, soft war in the 14 years since 9/11, and the West's approach has been hugely lacking. So, I mean, at the base of it, the sort of the digital aspect of this soft war is relatively new. It wasn't there so much in 2001. But what confidence can we have that that the hugely lacking effort is going to change at all then?
So as somebody who was a political appointee for Presidents Bush and Obama, who had been working on this for over a decade, I can tell you that even though people are talking about the war of ideas, and there's great change, by the way, in what our government and other governments have done over 14 years, we understand completely that the bad guys have been able to manipulate spaces that prey upon the crisis of identity. And Al-Qaeda did it in one way, and they used videos, and they used audio, and they used all kinds of things that were moving, you know, young kids in a forward direction. But right now, in 2015, the kinds of tools that the bad guys are using are the kinds of things digital natives who are millennial Muslims are just like everybody else, are using, whether it's Snapchat or Instagram or WhatsApp or Twitter, whatever the platform might be. Here's the thing. What we know is grassroots have piloted prototypes of things that they see at a nuanced and local level that can make a difference. And so if you began to look at the data analytics that are coming back to us, and you're able to look at how we measure change in terms of sympathizers towards extremist groups, you can see the potential and the possibility. Mm. No one has yet built the machine that can compete with the ISIS machine. And it's not because the machine can't be built, it's that we haven't built it.
Well,
and that's my point in the article.
Dean Najam, let me have you jump in here. What are you thinking?
I hope Farah is right. I really do. But I do think she's exactly right. We need a global response. And what that means, both militarily and digitally, it's ironic that the tools we should have been best at, Twitter, Facebook, right? Where were these things created? We seem to not know how to use in this battle. But where she's right is the global response, including on military. This is not going to be done by just a coalition of the willing, because that was really an admission that there were too many who were unwilling. This has to be a coalition of the whole. And the
who do we include there in the whole?
For example, Muslim countries. I think there is an opportunity there. It's not an easy one, but think back to Gulf War I. Think back to James Baker going and trying to convince those countries and getting them back in. In a way, ISIS is unlike Al-Qaeda in the sense that the entire Muslim world is even more scared of them than anyone in Paris is today. Now, this is not the best bunch of people to get together, but if Senator Kerry, if the world tries to do that, and that means working with guys we might not want to work with. Remember, there was a guy called Stalin? Remember, he was our ally because there was another guy called Hitler who was a bigger threat than him at that time. What that means is we have to start thinking differently, and we have to start thinking of this as an existential threat, not to my city, not to my country, but to the world, at a people level, at a state level.
Farah Pandit, I mean, respond to that, because taking the long view like that seems to make sense. I mean, I hear Dean Najam say it, and it makes sense, but we're also in the beginning of a presidential election cycle. We have immediate responses that, you know, we hear candidates say we should only allow Christians into the
country.
But
that's the thing. If it is going to be partisan, then it really hasn't hit home.
Right. So we have competing forces here. I mean, if it's Go ahead.
But there are different elements to this. One is a government response, and Dr. Najam was talking about building coalitions of Muslim majority countries as well, getting into this. And there is particularly policy side and political side, there are elements to this that are important. Sharing of intel, understanding, you know, how we think about things. But let's be really clear. You cannot get into an ideological fight unless the global response is countries around the world that understand that their kids are being preyed upon by predators online. And unless you humanize that problem and make regular citizens understand that this is also their fight, that they cannot wait for governments to get their act together to figure out how many people on the cheat sheet we have from Muslim majority countries and how many we don't, that indeed that communities at large are at risk because their kids are at risk.
But Farah Pandit, let me jump in here, because I hear what you're saying. But on the other hand, who is going to do that humanizing? It, as you said, it cannot come from governments. It perhaps can't even come from the West. If we're talking about families in Tehran, families in Syria, who, you know, in Saudi Arabia, wherever, that those are the people who need to worry about their children and what they're seeing online.
No, Meghna, it's every country in the world needs to worry. It's not just the countries you think about. This kind of recruitment is happening in places that people don't even talk about. In Brazil and Argentina, they make a difference. And people can say, well, why does that have anything to do with me? An idea in Malaysia is as real to a kid in Montreal as it is to a kid in the Maldives. I mean, this is not about, you know, which part of the world. It's about how the ideas are spread to a millennial generation that are absorbing an us and them narrative and are moving emotionally towards that narrative, whether it makes sense to us or not. So when you ask who needs to get into it, it's local, very, very local community efforts in a wide range of ways that need to be funded by communities themselves in the way that they can have
right.
a proportional response. That's in the offline space.
I just need to let Dean Najam here jump in here for a second.
Very briefly, she's right, but yes, it's happening. You know who's most scared in Boston today? Muslims who live in Boston. The mosque I go to. People are scared of two things. One, what is the backlash going to be on me? The only thing they're scared more of, they understand it's their kids. They're scared of ISIS. So in a way, they're scared on both sides. So I think it is happening. I look at my Twitter feed. As soon as Paris happens, every Muslim, you know, I have 40,000 or whatever followers, they put up the French flag. So I think that conversation is happening. It is critical. It is not enough, though.
Right. Well, Farah Pandit, we just have less than a minute to go. But if the solution, long-term solution, is truly distributive, as you're saying, and not necessarily top-down, how do we get there?
We get there by understanding that at a local level, you can insert your financial resources into activities at the grassroots level. In the Bloomberg View piece, I named several organizations that are doing great things, and I would have your listeners go to that piece and learn how they can take part.
Well, we'll put a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. Farah Pandit is the first ever special representative to Muslim communities. She was appointed under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. She's an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Very good to talk to you, Farah Pandit. Thank you so much. And Adil Najam, he's the Dean of the Party School of Global Studies at Boston University. Dean Najam, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.